I think that black people welcome any solution, a short-term solution that will ease the burden. And the Black Panther Party more or less attempts to interpret the desire of the community and then organize their desires in some systematic fashion so that we could set up an administration to give them what they want. Now, the Black Panther Party welcomes any change in the community. For instance, if someone, interested person, wanted to give money to the black community so that we can set up our day nurseries, hospitals, and so forth, that we welcome this effort because it wouldn't even be in a counter-revolutionary fashion as it is in some other countries that I can imagine, that where many progressive or revolutionary people would speak against this for the simple reason it tends to give the people the illusion that they can gain their freedom through these short-term reforms. In this country, black people are so frustrated. Black people have been enslaved so long until no one can give them, no one can pay them off or with a short reform to satisfy us. If this were the case, then the poverty programs would have stopped all insurrections. But the poverty program has not stopped the rebellions. Even though, as far as the poverty program is concerned, that we don't speak directly against the poverty program. We educate the community and show them where the poverty program will not liberate us. The poverty program is just what it says it is. It's a program for poverty.
WBAI New York.
And it's a program to perpetuate poverty. Even though a few people, a handful of people in the community are, quote, help, it ends up that the people who don't need the help are getting most help out of it. And these are the people who are highly educated, and they're getting the incomes, the large incomes from the poverty program. So as far as the black community is concerned, it wouldn't stifle our liberation move for some interested people who happen to be naive to come into the community and to give monies for little reforms. A few of our people will be helped, but the mass of our people will not be deceived that this is the answer to the problem. The answer is more basic than that. The answer is a complete change, because we know that these little reforms won't give full employment. We know that these reforms will not make decent housing for all of our people, and that because it won't make decent housing for all our people, then the revolution will go on. If it did make decent housing, full employment, justice in the courts, then of course it wouldn't be a reform, then it would be a revolutionary thing, and we would welcome it wholeheartedly, because it would not only save many white people from destruction, it would save many black people.
In this community, there has been a great deal of attention focused on this whole situation, partly because of your case, partly because of the Hutton case, the Eldridge Cleaver case. I personally have had a sort of hope, I can't put it more than that, that this area is more aware and has become increasingly aware down through the years, particularly the younger people in the community, beginning with the Huac riots, the FSM, the draft resistance movement, all sorts of growth which has taken place in this community. I'm told by people who visit this part of the world from other parts of the United States that there is a perceptible difference in the whole political climate of this area. Right now, there are white people, not only the coalition with the Peace and Freedom Party, which developed at their conference, but unorganized white people who are asking, and meaning it, I think, what they can do. Do you feel that there is a possibility that in this area, at least, we might be able to bring about some of the basic changes which would be necessary to have a civilized community, and that it could possibly be done through political and organizational and educational means? I mean, what is the role of the white person in this community who genuinely wishes to align themselves with the struggle for black liberation in the full sense of that word?
In the first place, I would like to start again and make something quite clear, because people refuse to accept it as a truth that I think it's very true. And the first thing is, let's get what politics is about again. Our definition is that politics is a war without bloodshed, and war is politics with bloodshed. Even though politics has its particular characteristics that are peaceful in nature, when these characteristics are exhausted and the people who are demanding don't get what they want, then politics is continued. And it usually ends up into a physical conflict, which is called war, and which is a very political action, because the people are still trying to achieve their liberation, freedom, and justice. So I make no division between the politics of war and the other characteristics of politics. I think at this point that the black people over a few hundred years have exhausted the peaceful means. I think that we've gained everything we can possibly gain through peaceful means, and that now it's at a point where white people, if they don't think they've exhausted the means to bring about change, then they could put pressure upon the controllers of the means of production and the government officials to stop their oppressive ways, to revolutionize the government, to change the system completely so that the people would be in control of the means so we can employ ourselves. And also within this, it's very complicated in this country, because it's my belief that black people have a right to secede the Union and be a free republic if they so desire. One of the demands that we make is that after we gain the necessary power, which is part of our program, matter of fact, that we will ask for a plebiscite set up by the UN, and we'll have the UN advisors to come in to see that black people get a vote, and we will vote as a people to see if we want to stay a part of this country or not. We've never been treated fairly in this country. We've never received justice in this country. And many black people are disillusioned with the position that we have here, and that we might want some land of our own. But as far as what white people who are conscious of the shortcomings of the this structure, they can aid the revolutionary people of the black community, and they can also put pressure upon the government and upon the private owners to change the system. And when I say change the system, I'm also including that I don't believe that the private owner can actually give full employment. Number one, because of his profit motive, that he's only going to try to get richer and to pay the people as little as possible. So I think that they have a tremendous job on their hands to change the basic economical structure of the country. And I don't know any time in history where a government has been changed where you had a private profit motive there, and suddenly they changed and became humanitarian and instituted a socialized government. And that the Black Panther Party advocates the people owning the means of production, the people owning the housing, are controlling the housing through elected administrators, and so that then these administrators would be at the mercy of the people, and the administrators will organize the people's wealth in such a manner where the people enjoy a high standard. I don't think that there's ever been a time in history where this change has come through any peaceful means. Although I would like to see this happen for the first time in this country.
You've been listening to a taped interview with Huey Newton, founder of the Black Panther Party, when he spoke with KPFA's public affairs director, Elsa Knight Thompson, before his trial and subsequent imprisonment on a murder charge in California, in Oakland. This is Pacifica Radio in New York, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM.
Running about 4.5 minutes behind schedule. We hear next an interview with Eldridge Cleaver, Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party. Cleaver left the United States several years ago following the placing of weapons charges against him in California, growing out of a confrontation between the Berkeley police and the Black Panthers. He reappeared in Algiers, where this interview was recorded during the Pan-African Cultural Festival last summer. This tape was made available to us by radio station VPRO, a listener-sponsored station in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. The tape has been edited to remove portions in the Dutch language, and the music you hear in the background was added by VPRO as part of its production of the interview. Now, an interview with Eldridge Cleaver, recorded in Algiers about 10 months ago.
Would you like to live in Africa for your whole life?
No, I would not like to stay in Africa for my whole life, because I have business to take care of in other places, and I can't do it from here. Well, that's the smallest part about it, you know? But it really boils down to an ideological conflict that centers around whether or not the most efficient machinery would be that based on Marxism-Leninism, or as it works out in Africa, Black nationalism. That's what it really boils down to. And
were you talking about, you remember?
I think we were talking about, did I have a mission in Africa and the difficulty that we had expected?
Yeah.
And the point was that a lot of people are arriving at some of the same conclusions that we had arrived at. And what it really involves is a realization that all the struggles for the liberation of the colonized people have learned that it's not enough to just become independent or to develop a movement for independence. What's required is to have machinery and a movement that's based on revolutionary principles with a very strong ideology that goes beyond the narrow appeal to what basically must be called ethnocentrism or Black nationalism or yellow nationalism or whatever, you know? So that in Africa, You can go back to 1955 to the Bandung Conference in Indonesia, when there was kind of a debate as to whether people should try to develop Marxist-Leninist organizations or should they move for their liberation on the basis of nationalism. And since nationalism was easier to manipulate, a lot of people opted for that as an easy way out. And they were able to achieve their independence. But in that period, in this 14-year period, there's been a wave of counter-revolutionary activity, and many of those countries that got their independence on the basis of nationalism have found themselves victims of situations that's very detrimental, that they've been plagued with these military coups and their countries have fallen apart. It's been proven that nationalism alone is not sufficient to hold a nation together. And the only countries that have been able to withstand this counter-revolutionary tide has been those countries that have had Marxist-Leninist organizations, strong Marxist-Leninist organizations in control of the government. And you can just count them the Soviet Union or China, Cuba, and the Eastern European socialist countries. You can have your criticisms of revisionism, you know, in Eastern Europe and all of that, but it still boils down to the solid fact that the countries that didn't have even that form of an organization have found themselves being pushed backwards. So these guys who are still fighting for the liberation, they are benefited from this experience, and they're taking the steps now to avoid that when they do achieve their independence. And they are trying to develop strong political machinery that's based on revolutionary principles and to get away from the ethnocentric aspect. So that this was very welcome to us, because we had taken that position, and in the United States it amounted to going out on a limb. But we find that we were not the only ones out on the limb. The limb is very crowded, and that it's very reassuring, and it's nice not to be alone in that position. And this is one of the most important things that's happening. There is a danger, you see, in people being so hung up on what's going to come after the revolution that they cannot move now. You find a lot of that. There's some people who won't move until they know exactly what's going to come next. There's some people who won't move until they know exactly the form and the structure of a new society. So that this particular statement that I made in this pamphlet was designed to combat that, and that's really rampant in the United States. You have a lot of people who really, in my opinion, are afraid. They're full of fear and just full of a lot of negative attitudes towards the whole possibility of a revolutionary struggle in the United States. And they use all of these excuses. And to look as far ahead as you can, I don't think would be inconsistent with advice not to get hung up on looking into the future, you know. So it's a question of a balance. I think that the reason that I'm here is because it was possible for me to come here and to come here publicly, you see. There are other places that I've gone that I couldn't go there publicly, you know. And the fact that they were willing to hold this festival, the fact that they were willing to invite the Black Panther Party as official guests, the fact they were willing to allow me to surface here. All of this, I mean, it indicates to me that they're willing to take a few bumps if they, you know, if they come out of this. But I think that even setting that aside, that you can only talk about Algeria, Guinea, and Tanzania. But then you find there are many problems related to that, that to my way of thinking, places a negative light on most of the other countries in Africa in terms of which one is the most revolutionary. I think that Algeria is the most revolutionary country on the continent. Well, see, my own thinking, I don't make a distinction between culture and politics. I think that it's a false distinction, that it's only an analytical distinction, because the life of a people is really one whole. There's not something over here that's politics, something over here that's economics, something over here that's sociology, and something over here that's, again, something else. I think that it's all just one whole, it's the life of a people. And to focus on this particular aspect of the culture, I don't think it in one bit de-emphasize the political aspect. To me, this whole festival is highly political. I think that everyone here is functioning in a very political manner, and I think that that's correct. Well, it may be that that would serve to reinforce that type of thinking, but that doesn't bother me. I don't care what they think in the European countries, you know. If they want to think that, I mean, their dances look funny to me, you know. So that I don't care about that. But to me, like, we didn't come here to dance or to sing songs, you know. And we're not interested in that. And we think that the only culture that's worth preserving, or the only culture that people in our situation should have, would be a revolutionary culture, you see. I think that a lot of people are very uptight, and they want to exhibit some cultural activity in order to impress people. And there's this great inferiority complex that oppressed people develop. And they're constantly comparing their own achievements with the achievements of the oppressor. And one of the ways that the oppressor has really insulted a lot of people and made a lot of people feel inadequate or inferior is by elevating his own culture to a preeminent level, and by denigrating the culture of the oppressed people, you see? So that these people are very anxious to prove that they have their dignity, and that they too are artistic, and they have their culture, and all of that. And as far as I'm concerned, some of the countries that are participating in the festival are countries that are very reactionary. And reactionary governments make everything about their country reactionary. I know that many people, particularly those who are still involved in liberation struggles in Africa, take a dim view of the emphasis on, you know, this culture, on dances and folklore. If they take a dim view of that, and they are only interested in waging their wars of liberation. So I think that's the most relevant approach to it myself.
What do you think about what Tom Mboya said about the Back to Africa movement? He said the black people in America shouldn't use Africa as an escape, but as a guidance.
Yeah, he's dead, isn't he? From the best information that I can get, the separatist movement in Biafra does not serve the purposes of the Nigerian people as a whole. That is an attempt by certain outside interests to perpetuate divisions and to play upon certain conflicts that exist there, and that it's like a rehash of the situation that existed in the Congo when the Congo received its independence, and the Katanga province tried to break away under Moise Tshombe. So that I don't feel that the cause of the Biafrans is a just cause. I think that the interests of Nigeria and for Africa as a whole is in centralization and continental unity in the first place, but also certainly keeping these smaller units intact. So that my reaction on the basis of the information that I have now is to oppose the Biafran situation. Well, the Black Panther Party is an all-black organization, and it's that way for certain specific reasons. We've run into situations where people look at our organization and they say, well, you guys are racist, you know? So this has been one of the problems that we've confronted, and we think that people are beginning to understand. I know that in the United States, we've gotten over that hump and gone beyond those charges so that people can understand what we're doing. And the Black Panther Party is a black organization. Now, it's that way because of certain historical facts that you have to deal with in the United States. And you start with the understanding that the United States is composed of many ethnic groups, you know. And you have, in terms of the revolutionary struggle, Mexican Americans, you have poor whites, blacks, Indians, Chinese Americans, Puerto Ricans, and Eskimos, you know. And all these people are involved in subcultures. And there's a lot of ethnic conflict in the United States, so that it has proven to be impossible to have one organization into which you can pull all these people and to move in a revolutionary manner. That has been proven impossible. And our approach is to organize machinery in these various ethnic stratas, organize the revolutionary elements within each group, and then put all of these revolutionary groups that have been organized into some machinery through a process of coalition. And I think that you achieve the same purpose, the same goal, but you don't come into conflict with the realities of the situation. So that in the sense that you're only talking about the Black Panther Party, it's true, it's a black organization, and it's designed to cope with the problem of organizing black people in the black communities, the black ghettos of the United States. But it's not true to say that because of that, the Black Panther Party is a racist party and it doesn't have relationships with other people of other ethnic groups. That we do this through a process of coalition. We look upon integration as being really just a political rhetoric, because in the first place, black people are scattered throughout the United States, and we have a form of decentralized segregation, you see, that you're there, but you're not there, you know. You're able to live here, you're able to live there, but you're still subject to the control of this system, and you have no say-so over how that system is manipulated, you know. So that we say that we're not a separatist organization and we're not an integrationist organization. On that particular question, our political position is to call for a United Nations supervised plebiscite that would allow black people to cast a ballot and to go on record for the first time in history as to what they want. And another plebiscite to be held amongst white people, opposing the question to black people of whether or not they want to be integrated into America, and posing the question to white people whether or not they want black people to become part on an equal basis of the society of which they are members, you see. I have a negative attitude towards the negritude. I think that it's a category to which you can also lump this thing of black power. I think that black power is a negritude concept. And I understand negritude historically as being necessary when black people had lost a self-concept and a perspective on themselves and their culture, and needed kind of a revamping of their whole outlook. And in the United States, this took the form of black identity coming into vogue again, people who formerly had been made ashamed of their hair or their skin color and their whole ancestral background, their relationship with Africa, and all of that.